Blog Talk Radio.
Had it maybe 15, 20 times. Blog my life Talk Radio. I certainly believe it.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Thanks, Mom. That's Mom out in the audience. One person's my mother. She's real excited, real enthusiastic. Enthusiasm is the God within you. Thanks again, Mom. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which has, like some of you know, have shrunk down the GSO. It's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, has produced through the auspices of The Grapevine, which is our monthly meeting in print, a book called One-on-One Sponsorship. It's the first time that this organization has produced such a work in 78, going on 79 years of its existence. It's never done anything like this before. Some pamphlets have come out, very limited amount of information on sponsorship, other than what's directed in the big book. And of course, the big book is the basic text. There's not a lot in there, although it can be dug out. And our guest speaker tonight, our guest interview, has dug it out. But for most folks, they haven't dug it out, so we did Rum Radio to give you some overview of what sponsorship looks like. This is One-on-One. The name of the book that they've done is called One-on-One Sponsorship. I think it's a game changer. I think it's a directional book. It tells us that it's been ascertained or discovered that sponsorship is critical into the recovery community, and that's becoming back into the forefront of this understanding of recovery. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation because they believe in what we're doing. Thanks again, boys. You know, every little bit helps. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and it afforded us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, and basically so does the world. A lot of disturbed families and children out there. I like to think of most of the problems we have with alcohol and drugs come from the inability of most parents to teach their children correct principles. Once you teach your children correct principles, then they can teach themselves. But unless those correct principles are given, and a lot of parents, or quite a few parents, do not even have those correct principles, so now it's becoming generational. Of course, drugs and alcohol are getting worse and worse as the time goes on. There's more and more of this incident. We find this to be what fills up our prisons. Harold also goes to the prisons. And the dysfunctional families, it's a huge cost to society as a whole. So I applaud Harold's work, taking it to the prisons, taking it to the, as a professional, helping with the families. How you doing tonight, Harold?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Joseph, for that nice introduction. And I just wanted to take a minute to encourage our listeners to call in, be part of the program. The call-in number is 949 949-534-0621. 949-534-0621. You can listen on that number, and then if you'd like to ask a question or speak, add a comment, you press the number 1, and that gets you the attention of our switchboard, and they will let you participate in the program. We also have a chat room set up for the program, and to get to that, you go to rumradio.org, rumradio.org. In the upper right corners, you'll find the word live. You click on that, and that will, by looking over to the right, you'll be able to find the chat room, so you can ask a question that way. And about families, I'm really grateful to have an opportunity to give back. I've received a lot of benefit from the 12-step programs, and especially from my sponsors. I wouldn't have made it without them. And part of this, the whole process is that you find a sponsor and or let your sponsor find you. You go through the 12 steps, and that prepares you then to be a sponsor, to lead somebody newer through the 12 steps. That's really the spirit of this program. That's what makes everything go. That's what gives us long-term recovery. And without that process, I wouldn't have made it. This is my way of giving back. One more comment. I want to let all our listeners know that Joseph doesn't make money from this radio program or the website, rumradio.org. In fact, he's sunk thousands into it to keep the website going and updated, just as his way of giving back. And so I appreciate him for all of that. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Well, I'd like to start the program before I introduce you to our host. This is a second time with Michael M. from Chicago. He's the fellow who did the web on the website. We have 4 videos, how to take someone through all 12 steps in 24 hours. I have it listed under the written materials, listed under 12 and 24, Dr. Bob times 5,000. And the reason why that title is Dr. Bob had sponsored 5,000 men. Primarily what it was is it was at, I believe, St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. There was 5,000 men that came through that, and him and Sister Ignatia worked with these 5,000 men. And so it was a very quick process back then. The website goes into it a little bit more, the surrender, getting into the steps, doing an amends quickly, and then going and finding someone you could work with. And we found, if you look at the big book, it says 50% got right away, and I believe 25% after a few relapses. So that's a 75% success rate doing it the way the pioneers did it. They had it going on. So we're looking back at that and saying, hey, wait a minute. Maybe they did have something that we need. So Michael does that. He brings it back. It's like a history lesson. On cards I give out, I have sponsorship, a look back to the future. I believe this is the future of recovery, and this is what's going to get us around the curve and back on track again. But before I introduce you to Michael, I'd like to start the program with the third step prayer. Most recovery meetings start with a prayer. It's called an invocation. It invites in the spirit. I think it's a good way to start something that we try to be spiritual, humorous, and program proper. So it gives a nice lay of the land. The third step is also, it's found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text. Disclaimer, this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not NA, which is Narcotics Anonymous. This is not CA, which is Cocaine Anonymous. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're actually closer to Paranoids Anonymous, but nobody will tell you where they hold a meeting. And if you can stick with us for the whole hour, you might think it's Narcoleptics Anonymous. We don't represent anyone other than Rum Radio. That's our deal. That's what we represent, period. I like using the big book because the big book is the template of all 12-step recovery programs. The 12 steps come from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Usually, in most of the other 12-step programs, groups, the only thing that's different is the first step, which mentions the addictive substance, the problem. The other 11 steps we call the solution or a design for living. So we're all pretty close right there except for the problem. The problem changes up a little bit. Everybody has something if you dig in, but we find that alcohol and drugs are what we're going to concentrate on. Personal note, I believe that when you sponsor someone, you need a certain amount of personal experience, which will give you the empathy to relate to your new sponsee. If you don't have the empathy of experience with that particular drug or addiction, you can have sympathy but not empathy. And empathy is really critical in one person with a like illness talking to each other on a level of understanding that really puts a cement on the ability to interact and communicate. That's my opinion. You get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. This has been one of them. The third step prayer is one of the first assignments I give to my sponsees. A new sponsee starts off as a prospect. The big book says, go find a prospect and start working on them. Also says if the person's not interested, that's okay. Go find someone else desperate enough who wants what you have. So it tells us, it gives us clear-cut direction how to go find someone. What's happened today is we expect the newcomer who doesn't know the jargon, doesn't know the lay of the land or the culture to find the sponsors. This is already stuttering the recovery process, in my opinion. You know, we need to go get them. Get them started. Get them moving. Time is critical. Pain is the fuel. Once the pain is gone, the fuel of motivation is also dissipated, and his chances of recovery, the window starts to close. It doesn't close all the way for some, and a lot of folks have gotten sober that way. That's great. But I think for the bigger picture, time is critical. Get them when they're hot. Strike when the iron is hot. I think everyone's heard that. So I have a prospect. I ask him a couple questions. Have you had enough? Yes or no? Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? That telling me is also telling himself that he's made these agreements. If I get two affirmative answers, I tell him you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And one of the first things I have him do is get a home group. So this is their lifeline. Get 20 or so men's names when possible, and call them up and ask permission to recite the third step prayer. It's found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe men with men and women with women, because it's easier to relate to the same gender. 1, 2, sponsorship is an intimate relationship, so it could be easily misconstrued, and romance kills everything. So you want to try to keep it as clean as possible. Why add another hurdle? The key is, though, if it works with a different gender, you know what? You work the steps. You could always get another sponsor. This is the prayer, and I have them call up every day for the next 30 days. Now, of course, I do it a little different. I don't do it. I haven't done it the 24-hour deal like Michael's going to tell us about. I do it more like the Joe and Charlie, the Joe McHugh, the steps we took. I follow that kind of format. I'm a little slow in the change. I got to try it one of these days, but I'm not there yet. And then what I do is have them call them every day. You could do that, do 24s and still have them do this, and ask permission to say the third step prayer, recite the third step prayer to them. That has a couple of applications of understanding. One is it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects him up with his home group. They get to know his name, and they get to know he gets to know their name, and they get to know his name, which it makes a nice lifeline because the sponsor is not always available. Even after you work the 12 steps, if you do it in a hurry, you still have to mature inside the program. You know, that's a great start. That's not the end of it. It's the beginning of it. Thirdly, it encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the person he's thinking might have been thinking about picking up that first drink, first hit a crack, first whatever, chances are he will not, and you have your sponsee already in service. There's no guarantees, but we we try to keep in action, and we find action and more action. For faith without works is dead is in the big book. So we try to stay in an active role against the disease that's trying to kill us. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
All right. There's no amen on there, but I like that. I like an amen. It ends it up. Anyway, so Michael M. is going to talk about, Michael, you there?
Yes, I am here. Nice to talk to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Michael. Michael's been on before. He's on the videos on there, and we have the written material on the Rum Radio website. Michael was just saying, according to YouTube, there's been 100,000 hits to that site. How nice. That's the first three steps. I take, you know, people are slow on the uptake like me, most of us. So tell us about, okay, how did you come up with the 24 hours? That's not what you were taught, or was that the way you came in? Did you have a really savvy sponsor?
Well, I think what probably makes the most sense for me to say first is I really don't understand myself to have come up with anything. In fact, anything that I actually come up with, I would advise anybody to stay away from. You don't want my message. My message nearly killed me. I'm quite sure it would kill you. And I also want to say, the question you asked directly to your listeners, that I don't understand myself to be an expert or a pioneer. There's nothing you're going to hear me say that I haven't read in the big book or heard from somebody else. And so at best, I'm hopefully a conduit for God's love, and I'm passing along information. And I also want to say, some of you folks listening are not going to like me. And not because I don't want you to. You're not going to. And because you're not going to like some of the things I say. And it's not my goal. I'm available for it. But I want to say it's okay. I understand what things can be unlikable at times. I don't always like me. But I do want to say that my central mission is to get this message to as many people as I possibly can. And that's what I'm after. So if you hear me say something that disturbs or bothers you, I would just ask you to maybe take a second and let go for a moment of the person who's saying it and not get too wrapped up in me and see if there's something in it for you. You may feel the need to label me a big book thumper or a fundamentalist or even arrogant, and I think it's probably fair to say that all those things apply in some way. You know, I'm a drunk, and I'm a junkie, and I'm a sinner, and I'm kind of a mess without God. So I'll try to keep as much of my stink off it as I can. To answer your original question.
You know what I've discovered, Michael, and this might help? Some people don't know me, and they don't like me. Some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me, because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. Most people are just too busy thinking about themselves. But anyway, just to answer my question.
No, it was not the way I was originally sponsored. My original sponsor, Tom, is a wonderful, wonderful spiritual man, and he took me through with a pretty solid cadence. It was when I got sober in New York City. It was when I came out to Illinois and learned about what's called the Back to Basics program, which is a model of the beginner's meetings that Dr. Bob was using in the 30s and 40s, where they take people through over the course of 4 1-hour sessions over 4 weeks. I then came to find out that in advance of the beginner's meetings, apparently, cropped up because after they wrote the book, which was about the 5-year mark, so many people were streaming in wanting this message that Dr. Bob and his crew really couldn't handle all the folks that they were taking through
much, much quicker than that in a one-on-one way. And so they began these beginners meetings, which I believe were the first proper meetings. But previous to that, if you heard about what was going on in Akron and drove there, which a lot of people were, for the most part, you'd end up at Dr. Bob's house at, you know, 6, 7, 8 in the morning when the sun was coming up. And by the time the sun was going down, you'd potentially be making your amends and moving into 10, 11, and 12. So, and that's what most people were doing, is going through them within a couple of days. So what I want to be real clear about is I am not advocating that anybody go through the steps in a day, or even that that's right for everybody. What I'm advocating for is that you can. It's critical to know that you can, that you actually can do this work as quickly as you'd like, and you can get a solution into your life as quickly as you'd like, and you can become spiritually awake as quickly as you'd like. And so it's important to realize that the steps were designed with a very particular cadence. One is meant to flow right into the next. I no longer have a life, really, that's set up to take people through the steps in, you know, a 16, 17-hour shot. I mean, I've done it probably 15 to 20 times, and I would do it again if the opportunity arose. I got a wife and 2 kids and a business, and so I would say more often than not, it's more like a week or 2 weeks or a month. When somebody asks me to sponsor them, I tell them it is not the job of a sponsor to dictate the rate at which you go through the steps. The book does that just fine. So we can go through this work exactly as quickly as you'd like to, and then I just follow their lead.
Interesting. I usually try to set up a case. I do personally. I'll tell them we're going to try to accomplish this in 30 to 45 days, and then that gives me a time frame for each step. But you don't go along with that thinking process.
I'm not saying I don't go along with it. For me, at the end of the day, the path they're on, I believe to be about them and God. I'm really nothing but a middleman. I think at best I can be a solid spiritual janitor. You know, the sort of like the window you're looking out of shows you everything you need to see. It's just perhaps a little dusty and cloudy, and I can come along with a rag and, you know, kind of thing. So I'll sit down with a guy. I'll take him through the first 3 steps, and I'll say, well, you have a choice. You know, my wife won't be home for a couple of hours, so if you want me to give you the parameters for step 4 and you want to go home and do it and call me when you're done, fine. If you want me to get some paper and you want to start writing, fine. And if he goes home, I'll tell him, call me when you're done. If he calls me the next morning, I'll try to get over there that morning. If he calls me a month later, then I'll go over a month later. I don't chase people around. What often happens is he'll call me 2 weeks later, and he'll say, you know, my wife and I have been fighting, and my boss is making me crazy, and this, that, and I'll say, okay, how's your 4th step coming? And he'll say, that's not what I'm talking about. And I'll say, I know it's not what you think you're talking about, but what you're struggling with is resentment, and the way through that is finishing the list you're doing. So I'm not saying you have to finish it. I'm just saying when you're done with it, let me know. So rather than applying time parameters, which I don't think there's anything wrong with, if you want to get well, you can get well as quick as you want. And if you slow the process down to a point where you need a nudge, I'm quite sure God will handle that. I don't know that they need me for it.
I usually work it this way. Tell me what you think. I believe that you can work the first 3 steps sitting at a traffic light as long as it's not New York City. As everybody knows, the New York minute is made up of the nanosecond, the annoyed nanosecond. But other than that, right, the first 3 steps are basically just an agreement. The rubber meets the road on step 4. And my experience and personal experiences, that's where the stall comes. Some people take forever. Some people write War and Peace. Some people feel obligated to make it thorough. The big book says thoroughness will work and pay off handsomely, and some people want to write Tolstoy's War and Peace kind of deal, and it drags on, and then it's like, you know, I have to wax the cat, and I have to walk the fish, and I got to clean my room, and the step four gets pushed away, pushed away, pushed away. And some folks never really get to it unless until there's a tragedy and then they're forced to it. Is that your experience? Or?
Yeah, that is my experience. I agree with you. I think, you know, we often hear about people working step one, working step two. I don't understand that they're workable steps. I understand that they're information gathering steps. So if you can grasp the idea that you've had the experience of your alcohol or drug use getting away from you, i.e. you plan to drink A amount, ended up drinking B amount, and you get that you've had the experience of saying, I'm never going to do this again, but doing it again, and you're willing to believe that there's a God in this world, and you're willing to state that you'd rather follow him and let him take over than continue to enact the problem, then you got one, two, and three. I mean, I think a little expansion using the language of the book is useful, but not absolutely necessary. And yeah, it's very simplistic. And really up until that point, other than perhaps for hardcore atheists, of which I think very few walk into AA, everything's pretty simple. You know, if you've lived a life of shame and judgment and you walk in to a room full of strangers ready and willing to love you primarily for what's wrong with you, and there's hugs and free coffee and nice stories and phone numbers, and yet you're asked a couple of questions, and do you believe in God and say a prayer? Yeah, pretty simple. And then, you know, sit down, take out a piece of paper, write down all your fears, and right, they're gone. And I'm not, you know, that doesn't surprise me. I get it. And I would even go so far as to say that I don't know that I ever really believe that relapse is a bad thing, unless you die. That doesn't mean I take it lightly, but I feel confident that when people relapse, it's because they had drinking to do. And strangely, I don't want to say downside, but I can't think of another term. I think one of the potential downsides of the widespread nature of our fellowship is that it can be a little too easy to get to AA. Not that it shouldn't be. But in, you know, 1942, if you got in your car and drove 1,100 miles to Akron, you had probably hit your bottom. But these days, you know, some guy comes home drunk and his wife says, if you keep this up, I'm going to leave with the kids. And, you know, there's an AA meeting three blocks away and it'll shut her up. And he goes and he likes it because who wouldn't? I mean, the women are pretty and the coffee's hot. And he wants to be a part of, and so he hears you should work the steps, so he starts, and when he gets to a fourth step, he goes out and drinks again. That guy wasn't done drinking. And if he had just continued drinking to his bottom, he would have come in probably ready to work the steps. Now, unfortunately, he's tagged with this relapser label because now we hold so much shame around it, which is absurd. I know I'm getting a little off track, but so I think a lot of problems get set up that way. And I don't really believe any human being is going to do a fourth step until they're really at the bottom.
Well, that's why I really like your concept, is because I've discovered that pain is the fuel is the motivation to get people through the steps in a timely manner. You know, could thorough rob timely. You know, we're missing that window of opportunity where that pain is still acute, that they're willing to jump in. Are you willing to go to any length? And basically, are you willing to go to any length now? I asked a question one time at the local primary a couple of years ago. I was just curious how many people had relapsed. And I was surprised. It was about between 80 and 85% of the room raised their hand. It was a full room, too. So what I've come to the understanding was that the newcomer's life's blood to AA, just like the old-timer's the backbone, but relapses the soul, because there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze.
Yeah.
So my experience, if I get them through the steps quickly, I got a head full of AA in them, and I've ruined their drinking career. They're never going to drink again with impunity.
No, I think you really hit the nail on the head.
Have you heard this, that if you went out before you worked the steps, it's a slip, and if you go out after you work the steps, now it's a relapse?
I've heard it. Maybe that's true. I don't get too I don't get too wrapped in the terminology, to be honest. I don't have a problem with it. I just think that, you know, I hear people say, well, relapse isn't part of the program. Well, you know, it is if you relapse. And some people hit their bottoms. Some people hit their bottoms before they come to AA, and some people hit their bottoms in AA. And what sort of blows me away is how surprised people seem to get when people relapse. You know, almost to the point of being upset and appalled and aghast at it. And I talk to guys who say, you know, oh, this guy who doesn't call me, doesn't do what he should. Well, you know, what's wrong with this guy? I was like, what's wrong with him? Like, the same thing that's wrong with you. You know, we kind of, I always hear people say that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results, which isn't the definition of insanity. It's something nifty that Einstein said about insanity, which I think is
yeah.
cool. But the actual definition is derangement of the mind. And to derange means to throw into disorder. So the illness threw my mind into disorder. It scrambled my brains. I was delusional. So it's important for us to remember that what we're asking a newcomer to do in the first step is we're asking a delusional mind to smash a delusion. That's not easy. And I don't know why we get surprised when they can't do it right away or can't even do it over a period of time. I'm not surprised when alcoholics drink. I'm actually quite surprised when they stay sober.
Really? Well, I'm a one-chip wonder, so my ego was so fragile that I'm such a chatterbox, so I knew this whole program 90 days in. I could tell you how to work this thing, and I let you know that I knew. And so when it came that, when my cravings came, the opportunity to drink again, I didn't because I was really concerned what you might think of me. Of course, those things
are
passed now, but it helped.
I came in and stayed. So I've never had a relapse. I don't take any credit for that. And I don't understand that it means something special about me. I just understand it to mean I was done. I don't know why I was done. I was just done. And what was done for me was done by God. So, you know, I just celebrated 16 years a couple of months back. And, you know, when people say congratulations to me on my anniversary, I appreciate it. I do. And I take it as what it is. But there is something that seems odd about it to me because I don't really understand it as an accomplishment.
I'll tell you this quickly. Early on, I was 5 years, and I didn't pick up my five-year chip. And my sponsor called me up and said, how come I didn't participate? And I said, well, I says, we're really only sober one day at a time. I says, and I think that picking up chips are all about ego. And he paused and he said, you know, you're right. It's all about ego. It's all about your ego. He said, we pick up chips to show the new man that even a jerk like you can attain long-term sobriety. Oh.
Yeah. I would. I hear that. And you know, my navigation of how I deal with those things has moved over time, too. You know, there were decisions I would make like that I was quite sure were echoes of humility that turned out to be just louder echoes of shifted pride and ego. And my spiritual expansion and the way that God has afforded me the opportunity to grow has almost all come through being smashed to the ground again and again and again under the weight of my pride and ego showing up with different masks. And sometimes it's a really crushing experience, but there's always an incredible amount of growth from it.
So now, okay, so you've gotten them through, you get them through pretty quick. Now, you know, actually it does say 50% got it right away, so the assumption is that they didn't relapse, and then 25% relapsed a few times, and then they got it. So there's a precedent for relapse initially, although if it's done correctly, I believe the 50% really goes along, and I think Harold would go along, and you probably would too, is that the one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. And so we get the guy in the trenches. I take you through, and I tell him, I'm taking you through the way you could take someone else through. And after step five, I usually suggest to my sponsees, they're now available to be a temporary sponsor, along, well, along with now you could share in the meetings because now you have something to say and the pain is dissipated now. So I need you to get to another level of recovery. What do you think of that?
If my memory serves correct, I think this came up the last time we spoke. I would say, a place where we differ, but I mean, I don't need to be rigid about it. I would say that for me, I mean, I don't know about the term temporary sponsor. I mean, I think they're all temporary. I don't know what the other option would be.
Yeah, so there's that.
I agree, though.
All sponsorship is temporary. It's either temporary for a day or temporary for a lifetime or anywhere in between. I use the term temporary. I believe it eases the new man into not, you know, feeling that he's lassoed into a particular group. You know, he has to make that commitment. This is my permanent sponsor. The word permanent kind of gives a bad taste in your mouth, someone who's looking to run out of the room anyway. And temporary sounds like it's an easy getaway. That's why I use that.
And there may be great utility to that. I mean, and I actually think that's an interesting slant on it, and I would pray on it. I hear what you're saying. But I think part of the intrinsic problem there is a sort of a general misunderstanding through AA of what a sponsor is and what it's meant to be, and a real lack of knowledge and competency when it comes to schooling newcomers on what to look for in a sponsor and what it means to get one. So I understand a sponsor centrally to be somebody who has recovered from this illness by using the program in the book and has the willingness, a competency, and time to afford you the same opportunity. I'm a little reticent to offer to anybody that in seeking someone to act as a Sherpa toward their spiritual awakening, that they would want to look for someone who's not spiritually awake. Now, that is not to say that somebody who's been through the first five steps can't do any good for a newcomer, because, of course, that happens every day. But I don't understand that they would do it as a sponsor, but I think they could do it as a companion and as a friend and as a fellow sober person and, you know, get on the phone at night, chit-chat, go to a meeting, whatever. But, you know, I think the idea of sponsorship has gotten so warped in AA that oftentimes when somebody says to me, "Will you sponsor me?" what I say back to them is, "I'll take you through the steps," because that's the only thing that's the only way I know how to do that gig. What you want to do is just call me sometimes. I would do that for anybody in AA. I don't understand that to be sponsorship. If you want to hang out, if you want to talk, if you want some advice, whatever, we can do that. I'm not casting you off. But if you want me to take up that role, then what you're asking me to do is be a conduit for God's love. And I'm only taking on the role of serving God in a way that I absolutely know how to. And I know how to take someone through the steps. And so I'm very clear with them, this is how I sponsor you. Anything beyond this, I'm happy to do. I don't know that it's sponsorship, and it's important to make the distinction between what I know and what I don't know, because what I know is very little. So if a sponsee comes to me and says, somebody said it was a selfish program, is that true? I'd say no. Turn to page 62. If they come to me and say, what should I do about my girlfriend? I say, I don't know. I'm sure God knows. We could talk about it. So I'm pretty careful to start sentences with I don't know if I don't know, because too many people are sponsoring and offering themselves up as experts on things they couldn't possibly be experts
on. Yeah, maybe not. Yeah. The advice mill. Let me ask my sponsor. He's got all the answers. I usually advise people never to give advice.
Have a problem with advice as long as the sentence starts with, in my opinion. I mean, I'll give you an opinion if you'd like one. you know, I'm not going to vomit an opinion on you, but if you're struggling with a subject that I actually have some experience, strength, and hope on, then I'll say something like, in my opinion or in my experience, or you might consider it, or it occurs to me, or when this happened to me, here's what I did. But I make a point to let them know that's a different model of information than the step work we're doing. Because that stuff I will testify to is truth. And I will say those things to you in decisive statements, in that I believe that what I'm telling you is what God wants for you. I can't say that about anything that I can't back up from the book.
Well, let me ask you, let's get back on that. Okay, so that once you've gotten your step four and you're going to do the step five with him, he's decided to have you do the step five with him. And it says if you do it in 24 hours, it says he goes home and takes the book down off the shelf. I know people actually do that. They physically put the book up on the shelf so they can take it down. You know, they want to be – it's almost ritualistic because that's what it says in the big book. And you've done that, and you've gone through the fifth step. How long does it take you to go through a fifth step?
Well, you know, there's not a single answer to it, but in terms of, like, having taken people through in a day, first of all, regardless of whether I'm doing it in a day or not, my preference is to do four and five as a unit. If I can avoid sending someone home, that's my preference. I would rather sit down with paper and write as we talk. There's nothing wrong with going home and doing a fourth step on your own, but if I can avoid a guy sitting down with paper and all his pain and defects all by himself, I prefer to avoid it. So if I'm going to sit down with a guy and we're going to go through it, I've yet to meet anybody that I can't do a fourth and fifth step with in 2.5-3 hours. There's absolutely no reason it needs to take longer than that.
Let me. This is a good point. I came across this at a meeting several years ago with the survivors, and this fellow JP, he was 41 and he had like 20 or 21 years, and he looks young. You know, I go, well, when did this kid get sober? When he was 15? But anyway, his sponsor was an old timer. And he took him through this modality. It was called brief, brief, brief. All you put down on the fourth step was the name, the date, and the incident. Mm-hmm. Everything else was, and you know, just keep it brief and no more than you could write on one side of a legal pad. And then you would sit down with your sponsee and go through all that's outlined in the big book. But you would do that together, like lifting a couch, you know, your sponsor on one side, the sponsor on the other side. So you would go over, you know, how this affected you, the resentment, the fear, the sex inventory, the positive inventory, what was your part. It was all done when you sat down with your sponsor, and because it was only one side of a legal pad, you weren't going to be there more than 2 or 3 hours. Had you ever heard that before?
You know, I have. You know, the way I do fourth and fifth steps has honestly expanded over time. And what I do most predominantly these days, and I want to be clear, this is going to fall into the category of, you know, an opinion, but it's something that's worked well for me, is I'll say to someone at the outset, would it be fair to say that you've spent your life believing that you're worthless? You're garbage, you know, and they'll pretty much always say yes. And I'll say, okay, so what you have there is a hypothesis. And any hypothesis is only as strong as the data that supports it. So, you know, I mean, if a scientist had a hypothesis about a cure for cancer and just came to the AMA and said, like, no, you should do it, it'll work, no one would listen. You know, he's going to come with all this supporting evidence. So if you've spent your life holding this hypothesis that you're garbage, you must have some pretty compelling data. So I want to know what the data is. So what I'm asking you for is the top 10 most compelling pieces of data that would unequivocally prove to me that you're garbage. And I want you to think about this as if we're actually going to have a public debate, you know, like take a couple of podiums and judges, and you only get points for facts. So you have to create your platform. my side of the debate is you're not a piece of garbage. I already have my platform. So for the moment, don't worry about breaking things down into resentment, fears, this, that, whatever. Just the top 10 things you can possibly think of. And I'll ask them if you're willing to. And if they say yes, and then I sit down with the worst 10 things they can think of and can show them how none of those 10 things actually support that hypothesis, I have found we're about 90% done with the fourth and fifth step because everything from there picks up speed. And I'll go through the rest of it with them. But I think what's important to remember with the fourth and fifth step is it's not your life story. That's not the goal. The goal is we're looking for causes and conditions. We're looking for patterns. So that doesn't necessarily necessitate that I know every single fact about your life or every single inappropriate thing you've ever done, as long as you're not purposely keeping things off the list that probably need to be there. So I want to be as complete as I can be with somebody, but again, I've yet to ever meet anybody that, if they're being honest and forthright about it, needs to take more than a couple hours.
Interesting. Yeah. That's why, a couple, three hours should make the pattern of evident to both parties, and I think that's really the key. So you've gotten at that now. I've lost, not lately, but I had lost people on the sixth step, and I believe the reason why I was losing them on the sixth, now the big book says this is where it separates the men from the boys. You know, I like to think of it, the women from the girls, the goats from the sheep, and the hounds from the foxes. So there's a separation there. This is a critical step. But when you first look at it, it doesn't look like much. In the big book, you can cover, I think, 6 and 7 with the palm of your hand. It's like two paragraphs, if I remember. So it doesn't look like there's a lot to do in that. But I believe what happens is step 5 is in the 12 and 12, it says it's the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So you finish step 5, you develop a true kinship between God and man, and so now all the pain is gone. You're staying sober. You've done a good part of the work. You feel that relief from the confession and cleaning up the past. And now 6, if it's not done right away, the motivation is gone because the pain is gone. You've reached a higher spiritual level. What do you think?
I think that's fair to say. I think there are some very specific points where people are prone to get sold on the idea that they've quote unquote got it. And I think this is one of those points, and it's attended to, you know, in the what we generally refer to as the fifth step promises. Within those promises, there is what I understand to be a fairly specific warning, in that, you know, it tells us that we need to go home and take the hour and et cetera, after we've, right before they give us those directions, it says, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, dark cranny of the past. And then they tell us once we've taken the step, withholding nothing, we're delighted, and we can look the world in the eye, and we can be at perfect peace and ease, and our fears fall away, we feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, now we begin to have a spiritual experience. Then it says, the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. That's certainly a promise. You know, if up till now you've been, kind of doing it a minute at a time, this may be the point at which you find it's Friday and you all of a sudden realize you haven't thought about drinking since Tuesday, and that's delightful. But they're also letting you know the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared is not the reality that it's disappeared. There's work to be done, so be cautious about that feeling. And I think people have a similar experience sometimes after the third step. And I think people sometimes have a similar experience when they first come in and experience the fellowship. So I think there are some real specific points where you have this burst of progress or a positive feeling that can create the illusion that you're all good. So I think sometimes that happens between 5 and 6. And to go back to the time thing, so, it's not more than an hour to do 1, 2, and 3. I can do 4 and 5 within another, figure 2-3 hours is maybe 4 hours. I'll have them take their hour of meditative time, so you figure that's 5 hours. Right. And then 6, 7, and 8 can't take, you know, wouldn't take more than an hour. So, you know, maybe we're through half a day. Now, the step 6 thing I do want to mention is, you know, I was doing fellowship. This is when I was back in New York City, and I probably had about 4 or 5 years. And for fun, I was just sitting with some people. Somebody said, I'd like everyone to say what their favorite chapter of the book is, what their favorite page of the book is, what their favorite paragraph of the book is, what their favorite line of the book is, and what their favorite word in the book is. Now, I don't think this is at all important, by the way, but the question comes up for me every now and then, and I just think about it just in terms of, like, because it's always moving. And recently I realized that I think currently my favorite word in the book is objectionable in the 6th step. And I think it's really important because, you know, it doesn't say, are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things we've admitted are bad? It says objectionable. So I don't understand the book to be selling the idea that lying and stealing, et cetera, are bad. Now, you may have a religious construct if you're a Christian. I mean, I think there's you can easily sell that those things are bad. But for the purposes of the book, the goal here is not to sell you on that those things are bad, but that those things are driving your illness. And so the hope is that I've come to object to these things because I spotted that my goal going forward can't be achieved if those things are still in my way. So, like, when a lawyer objects to another lawyer, he's not saying what the other lawyer said is bad. He's saying, I'm here trying to get justice for my client, and what that guy just said is not in keeping with that goal. Interestingly, the 9th step, which is upcoming, the principle for that step is justice. I want to live in a just world. I want to be a just person. I want to do God's work. And if I continue lying, cheating, stealing, et cetera, I can't pull it off, and I object to that. So I think that's a critical piece moving forward. And I think it's the piece that allows someone to move from having character defects to having character liabilities, which I think is the transference that will happen in step 6 and 7.
Interesting.
Good point.
So that, I'm sorry, say it again.
Excellent point.
Oh, thank you.
So then you got the 7. Now see, now he's got a spiritual. Now what I found is that the 5th step promises and the 9th step promises are almost identical. Have you found that or no? You don't see that? Or do you?
No, I think that's fair to say. I mean, I honestly think if you look at all the promises in the book, you know, I think if you take all the patches of promises in the book and put them together on one page, you would find a pretty consistent stream. You'd find a symbiosis. I mean, because I think collectively it really is one big set of promises. You know, they're just chunking them apart. So, yeah, I do. I think they're very similar.
And, you know, and then the big book says, and this, I've gotten into trouble for this because I used to pound on it a little bit, but then I had to back off. They say the big book is self-explanatory. And then, of course, it says before we're halfway through. So, and before halfway through comes at the 9th step. We're halfway through the 9th step, and then these promises start to occur, but basically we're less than halfway through with step 5.
Yeah,
see,
I don't.
No.
I do, first of all, believe that when they say halfway through, they are talking about being halfway through with your amends, not halfway through with the book or halfway through with the steps. And I don't believe it is true at all that the book is self-explanatory. If it was
okay.
Self-explanatory, it wouldn't be a textbook. It's our text. I mean, the whole idea of a textbook is that it isn't self-explanatory. You know, a not. And there, it may have been more self-explanatory in 1943, but in 2013, where it's chock full of words and phrases that haven't been in common usage in like 5 decades. I think it's insane to suggest to somebody that's self-explanatory.
well, this is what I've heard, you know, and I said, okay, wait a minute, you know, like, there's a lot of things in there that kind of convoluted. It's hard to grasp exactly what direction they were going with. I think working the steps in a timely manner really puts it back into a better perspective. I think when you take the big book and you drag out the process, that's when you lose a lot of forward momentum, understanding. You know, things come into play that normally would not have come into play because it's been dragged out so long. I had one here in Houston that when I came to town several years ago, it was like a step a month. And that was so...
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I...
The pamphlet
I
says
think that,
1 year.
Before first of all, I believe that is a treatment center idea, number one. And I don't want to, I really don't want to get a rant on treatment centers, but, you know, if somebody takes a good look at the 10-step promises, there are four distinct things in the 10-step promises that we're told will happen that haven't been mentioned before that point. We're told that we'll stop fighting. So if you've lived your life on defense, this is the point at which your dukes can start to come down. We're told that sanity is returned. So you're sane again. Mm-hmm. We're told that we're protected. We're safe and protected. So if you've lived your life feeling unsafe, this is where you get that back. And it says the problem's been removed. And that's not going to happen until you're into step 10. Therefore, to tell someone that you're going to work a step a month and it's going to take you a year to get through this is to tell someone it will take you a year to stop fighting. It'll take you a year to be sane. It'll take you a year to be safe. And it'll take a year before you're free of this problem. I understand that to be a death sentence for a good portion of people who come into the rooms. And I think it's an insane thing to say to somebody. And it's abuse because you have no backing to say it. It doesn't actually come from anywhere. B, it's wrong. And C, if you're saying it decisively, you're giving them the impression that's actually the model of AA, and they don't know better. So that's, I think, the problem a lot of people run into with sponsorship. That if you're touting information that you can't back up from the book, the newcomer does not have the tools to know that you're not giving them the gospel. And they will therefore treat it as if it is a rule. And so we need to be unbelievably cautious in terms of what we're telling them. Now, if somebody says to me, I want to work a step a month, well, that's a different story. If you want to take a year to work the steps, knock yourself out. I mean, I know no shortage of people with beautiful recovery who took 2, 3, 4, 5 years to go through the steps. I know more people who tried to take that long to go through the steps whose funerals I've been to. So I don't think it's a great bet, but I'm not saying it can't work. I just don't understand it to be optimum because the steps really are set up like dominoes, you know, and if you take dominoes and set them up the way you're supposed to, they'll do what they're supposed to do. They'll all go down. If you, you know, undo the line, move them an inch further away than you should, you might get them all down, but the chances are, at some point, you're going to run into trouble. So I don't know that the question is, how should I do this? But what is the most optimum, efficient way to do it? Because you're dying. So, you know, what's the cleanest, fastest way to get well, I would think would be the question.
Yeah, that is the question. I had a sponsee, too, that also, Dan from New Jersey, and in his group, they took the year that was in the pamphlet, because they suggest not to sponsor for a year in the AA pamphlet. And what they did with that year is that you had to go to meetings for a year, and then when you worked the steps, you didn't work it with a sponsor because sponsor's not in the big book, so you worked the steps at a step study a year later.
Yeah, which is, you know, is fine. It's just the whole year parameter in AA, you know, no sex or relationships for a year, no meeting, you know, leading meetings for a year, all those things are built on the idea that you would take a year to get to the steps. So if you're going to take a year to get to the steps, which right off the bat is fairly erroneous, then yeah, don't date anyone or have sex with anyone. Don't sell your house. I mean, if you're going to take a year to get to the steps, you're probably best off just like holding yourself up in a basement because you're not safe. But it's a faulty concept built on a faulty concept. So I don't really think it has anything to do with time. It has to do with how rapidly you recover. Once you've recovered, you've recovered. And I mean, I could point you to no shortage of people with less than 3 or 4 months of recovery who have unbelievable programs and are incredibly connected to God and helping others. And I could point you to no shortage of people who have 15 or 20 years and I wouldn't give a nickel for what they have.
Good point. So now, okay, so you got 6 and 7. How do you approach 8?
Well, 8, I mean, I think 8 is probably the simplest of them all. I mean, if you've done 4 correctly, 8 is mostly a process of transference. You know, if you've got a list of people you've harmed, if you've got people you've, you know, their sex inventory, you've probably come to see that many of the people who are on your resentment list, you also probably owe amends to as well. That should make up the lion's share of your 8-step list. And then, you know, take a good cursory look at anything else that needs to be on there or maybe any damage you've done between 5 and 8, depending on how long you've waited. Mm-hmm. And an 8-step list, you know, I can't imagine why that should take more than an hour. So, again, if I'm taking through someone through in a day, at this point, we've probably been sitting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 hours, maybe 7 if we've stopped to eat by the time we're, you know, looking over the 8-step list and, you know, plucking out a couple of amends that can be made rapidly.
Yeah, I like to think of the steps as like, to get 1 hangs by itself and 12 hangs by itself. But 2 and 3 are connected, 4 and 5, 6 and 7, 8 and 9, 10 and 11. And that 8 is really just a spiritual beginning. It gives you a willingness, right? It's a mustard seed step, I call it. You see that?
Yeah, I do. I think that makes sense. I mean, For me, I try not to break them apart at all, only in that I'll tell someone right out of the gate, you're not looking at, when you look at the structure of the steps, you're not looking at 12 processes. You're looking at 1 process. The numbers, I mean, honestly, they took the oldest spiritual concepts in the world and put them in simpler words and put numbers in front of them so drunks could understand them, but ultimately, it's 1 process. And, you know, and it's a system, you know, it's just like the body, you know, my esophagus and my pinky toe and my eye and my, you know, liver, they're all separate parts, but they're all one whole. And I think that's how the steps are. Because you couldn't break them apart in reality. They all have to have each other. So it really is one big process we're going through, and we want to go through it as efficiently as we can, because the principles is where we're trying to get. The steps, I mean, you know, the definition of step is to move forward to something. Principle is something you're grounded in and rooted in, which is why the 12th step doesn't end with practice these steps in all your affairs. You know, I don't get up every day and go out in the world and practice step 5. I practice integrity. So I want to get the steps into my life so I can start to live in spiritual principles, and then I'll have the rest of my life to you know, sort of root through the depth of what the steps have to offer. But the first pass through the steps, whether you take a day or a year, is ultimately a tourniquet. We're trying to stop the bleeding. You know, people get sold on the idea that you do the steps and solve all your problems, which is absurd. You know, I mean, you do the steps, which moves the crisis of addiction out of the way, so you have a shot to solve all your problems. So we really overcomplicate what someone needs to get out of their first pass through the steps, which I don't think is all that much to actually be able to recover from the illness and then open up the opportunity to start to deal with your life.
Yeah, that's a good point. Excuse me. Yeah, a lot of people think it's like a cure-all. As an alcoholic, an addict, I'd like to take a pill, read a book, get it done, move on. Is this a life process? What's up with that? You know, like, hey, I don't want to put that much effort into it. There's got to be an easier, softer way.
I have guys who call me, well, not so much anymore, but people would call me and say, you know, who've worked all the steps, and they'll say, I don't know, I don't understand this. You know, I'm still lying and scared and resentful. Like, oh, really? How unfortunate for you. I mean, you know, you didn't recover from humanity. You just recovered from alcoholism. You know, it's a real setup that people get it into their heads that they're somehow supposed to be all fixed and perfect and nifty. And I think it sets up an even bigger problem, because if people don't really understand the concept, then all of a sudden they're loaded up with this idea of walking into AA rooms looking like a recovered person, whatever that means, and they start hiding it when they struggle, as if people who've worked these steps shouldn't struggle, which is absurd. I mean, in certain ways I struggle more because I feel my pain more because I'm plugged into the world. I don't have an anesthetic. But I actually have the tools to deal with the pain.
Good point. So now you have them do the list, and of course the list comes from basically the fourth step, a well-executed fourth step will give you the names most of the time, but my experience is that names grow. The names grow as we're going through the process, but you in a sense, you've condensed it, so the time frame is fairly limited, which is okay. I think that's a better way to go myself, and then most people end up doing the steps a couple more times. I don't know why they do a fourth step. I tell them, well, unless it's about the past, then it should just stay in the past. If something comes up in the past, then another fourth step needs to be made. Otherwise, the tenth step should cover the rest of it. So now we're on nine, but some of those amends are going to take a period of time to accomplish. How do you overcome that in a short period of time?
Well, you know, when you get to step 10, you know, the first thing we're told is that we're going to engage this new way of living as we clean up the past, not after we clean up the past, which suggests that, and the new way of living is 10, 11, and 12. If we're going to be doing 10, 11, and 12 as we clean up the past, then 9, 10, 11, and 12, for all intents and purposes, are going to be worked as a unit. So therefore, my understanding is, you know, the number of amends technically that need be done before one moves into 10 really is one. I often will have them do a couple more than that. But if we've done the eighth step list and it feels complete and they're willing to make them all, I'll have them pick out, you know, two or three amends that can either be made, you know, people may be far away by phone or someone who's local that they can go sit down and visit with and come back if they wish, or something of that nature. But again, all that process is started. I mean, the idea that you have to make all your ninth-step amends before you can move to 10 is pretty crazy, because for some people...
No, yeah, that's
take a very long time.
What I do is usually I get them to commit. Will they commit to me to do this work?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if we've been sitting for 6 hours, we can do 6, 7, 8, you know, in less than an hour, or 7 hours. And within an hour, an amend or two can be made. You know, is 8. It doesn't take more than an hour to break down the parameters for 10, 11, and 12. So, I mean, technically, within a 12-hour period, including bathroom breaks and a meal or two, it can absolutely be done. And I would say, I mean, I've sponsored hundreds of people. I've taken hundreds of people through steps. If I look at, and I don't know this for sure, but the percentage of people who were getting well and staying well and sponsoring others when I was taking people through the steps in 6, 7, 8 months, I don't think is higher than the number of people that I've taken through the steps in 2 or 3 days. So I don't find it less effective, if they're being honest. I could point you to a good handful of people who I took through the steps within 24 to 48 hours who've been sober for years and, you know, helping others. So I don't think it's about how long it takes. It's just about how thorough you are. And the thoroughness, I don't really think, is relational to time span. If you're willing to be completely honest and go straight down the rabbit hole in 4 and 5, then that's going to be effective whether you do it in one sitting or whether you take 6 months. The question just is how fast do you want to get well? And how long you can risk waiting to get well has a lot to do really with how bad off you are. And I don't ever have that answer. So... And the other thing is how much willpower you have. And not everyone has the same amount of willpower. So if you take three guys and bring them into AA, it's possible that on just on riding the fellowship without doing the steps, one of them might last 2 days. Maybe one of them would last 3 months. Maybe the other guy would last 9 months. Who knows? But we also know they don't know. Because the thing about willpower that we all know is it is a limited supply. And so it will run out. And there's no willpower barometer. So at no point will your inside say, you know, you only have about 22 hours of willpower left. Like, the only way you're going to know you're out of willpower is when you're out of it. You know, so you're lying there in a puddle of your own puke, and it's like, oh, I guess I ran out of willpower last night.
Ran out of willpower,
and let's face
yeah.
it, like, puddle of your own puke is the best you could hope for. Death is the worst. So it's risky.
What's your take on the pain, that the pain is the fuel to get them through the steps in a timely manner? Once the pain is gone, of course, they're not drinking and drugging, and they're going to meetings, and my experience is the meetings will keep you sober. But if you're not working the steps, you're not in recovery. But there's people that have never worked the steps, never read the big book, and they're sober, and they're older,
yeah.
they have gray hair, and they tell people that this is how they were able to maintain the sobriety, by going to the meetings. So if I catch them when the pain is acute, then they're willing to agree to anything. If I tell them we're going to go through the steps in 15 minutes, and they're going to get well, or they have a good chance, they'll buy that, or 15 hours, or 15 days. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I think there is a great value to desperation, and I do think it makes a lot of sense to use that to your advantage when trying to help others. The best time to get someone moving on the steps is when they're desperate. So, you know, when people say, you know, they come in and they're all banged up, you know, give them a little time to cool out before you start on the steps. It's a fairly backward concept.
Yeah.
With that said, you know, it says in the foreword to the first edition that the purpose of the book is to show others precisely how they recovered. So what I understand they're saying there is, we're assuming you've come into this program and started this work and opened this book because you want what we have. So we are promising you, if you do precisely what we did, you will get precisely what we have. There was a time where I believed that it was also inferred that if you don't do precisely what we did, you won't precisely what we have. I don't understand that to be the case anymore. I believe they're saying, if you don't do precisely what we did, we don't know what will happen. We're just not promising you anything. So I do believe there are people, and I know people, who've, you know, either used the meetings or used some sort of amalgam of the steps or some, I'm not so firm as to believe that if you don't do precisely what the book says, you're simply not going to make it. I just think your chances go down immeasurably, and I'm not sure why anybody would want to risk that. So the big book really is set up in large part sort of like a cake recipe. So, like, if you came to my house and my wife made, like, red velvet cakes and you thought they were awesome, which they are, she's not proprietary about the recipe. She'll give it to you. So we could be sure that if you go home and follow that recipe to the letter, what will come out of your oven is the same thing you ate at my house. If you mess with the recipe, if you leave them in an extra 10 minutes or you don't put in the dash of salt or whatever, comes out of your oven may very well be red velvet cupcakes or a dessert, or maybe it'll taste good, but it won't be exactly the same. But the only thing you're risking by messing with that recipe is maybe a crappy dessert. With this recipe, you're risking death. So it's just important that you get that. That's all I'm trying to make clear to somebody. I'm not demanding anything of you. I'm just letting you know you've asked me to help you. And the best way I can help you is by letting you know the most direct, surefire route from restless, irritable, and discontent to happy, joyous, and free is doing precisely what's in this book. And that's what I'm going to tell you how to do. And you can do it or not do it. And if you don't do it and then relapse and don't die, and you want to try again, call me, and I'll receive you with the same love. I'm not going to say, told you so. So it's not my job to demand anything of anybody, and I don't.
What's your take on 12 and 12 where it says on step 5, until we've spoken with complete candor with someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what I hear is not only do I have to speak a fifth step, I have to hear a fifth step. And until I've heard a fifth step, I'm just circling the field because I still didn't belong, and I was waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline. What's your take on that?
I hear what you're saying. I think there's truth to that. I mean, when I finish the steps with someone, I tell them I want to get you sponsoring. Not you have to, but and I tell them, understand that I know you think I'm pushing this because it's what's next, or because it's the best way for you to stay sober, and those things are true. But I also want you to know that when you walk into an AA room and see people like me with double-digit years who are so jacked on the program, it seems like they came in last week, I'm telling you that is driven entirely by service. So
yeah,
what it is you're hungering for that you see in me and the guys I hang around with, this is what it is. This is where it's at. This is what it's all about. And so do I think someone can work all the steps, recover, sponsor no one, and stay sober? Yeah, probably. But I don't understand why. I mean, I've met those people, guys with 10, 15 years who maybe did just enough service work to kind of keep themselves up and running. But I meet them, and they're just kind of like in AA. they're there. They're okay, and if that's good for them, that's fine. I just remember my sponsor saying to me, you can get as well as you want. There's no ceiling. You can get as healthy as you want. And, like, I decided then I'm shooting for the stars, and service has been the engine for that, and it's certainly the engine for what makes the program work. So, yeah, I think there is such a thing as a recovered person who isn't sponsoring people, but the gap between being someone who's recovered and not sponsoring and being recovered and really being knee-deep in service is an enormous gap.
And now, okay, now we have also, it says, what we have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our daily spiritual condition. So I put it to you this way. Maintenance, I think, was the wrong word, but nothing really maintains itself of itself. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually, and if you're declining spiritually, your sobriety and then your recovery and then even your sobriety becomes tentative, and that leads us into 10, 11, and 12.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, like, if you have if someone had a house and they're really interested in building onto it, building up, building out, maybe even doing, you know, multiple projects. The process of building up and out in a house can be really glorious and lovely and exciting, and that's awesome. But the house also has a foundation that needs to be strong. So if you're building onto a house, but there's some kind of fault in the foundation that needs shoring up and it doesn't get dealt with, the whole house will fall down. So in that respect, I believe 10, 11, and 12 are maintenance and growth in that I'm both maintaining what I worked to have and building on it. And again, I'm not rigid about the terminology, but, you know, in 10, 11, and 12, ultimately, we're given 5 things we need to be doing regularly to maintain what we have and build on it. I need to be doing regular 10 steps. So when I spot that I'm full of fear or, you know, pissed at somebody or been selfish or dishonest, I need to turn it over and go through the steps they give you for 10. I need to be praying and meditating in the morning. I need to be in touch with God during the day. I need my spiritual review at night from page 86. And I need to serve other people. So what my sponsor taught me is, going forward now, there are going to be 2 basic ways for you to be in pain. There's the way where those 5 things are solid, where you can say, I'm doing 10 steps when they come up. I start and end my day with prayer. I talk to God during the day, and I'm doing service. Where you then get to tell yourself, I guess this is where God needs me today, in pain. The other model is when that foundation isn't solid, in which case you don't get to say that because that's self-imposed crisis. So for me, 10, 11, and 12 are pretty much summed up that way in the five basic parameters we're given, the five basic tools we're given to maintain everything we've gotten and build on it, which is, in effect, the act of going through 1 through 9 on a daily basis.
Right. It's 10 is steps 1 through 9, taking in a single package in the present.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that to be the case. I mean, I've heard many ways to split this up, and I don't think there's one way. I believe another way to look at it is 10 maintenance is 4 through 7, because 4 through 7 is where I dealt with my own insides, and 10 is where I maintenance my own behavior. 11 maintenance is 1, 2, and 3, because 1, 2, and 3 is where I cracked open letting God into the equation, and I'm working on that in 11. And 12 maintenance is 8 and 9, because 8 and 9 I did my amends, 12 I'm dealing with others. All of those, I have found endless nifty ways to kind of break it up in different metaphorical viewpoints, and I think they're useful because the material in the book can be a bit nonlinear and can be a bit cold, so I think that stuff is useful as long as it doesn't overtake the core message. You know what I mean? Like, I tout them as nifty and interesting.
Yeah, it makes sound bites, makes the person think. I mean, I put it to you this way with especially step, well, I think 10 and 11 are connected, but 11 is, it really works well during the football season. Prayer is the quarterback. Meditation is the feedback. And self-examination is the goal line. The unexamined life is not worth living, and a life in recovery is to die for.
Yeah, amen. Absolutely. I mean, for me, once someone recovers, as far as I'm concerned, it's all about God. It's all about worship. It's all about staying connected. You know, my problem isn't so much alcoholism as it is idolatry. My problem is making other things God. And once I make God God, my central task is to stay close to God and in his arms. And everything going forward is about that as far as I'm concerned. Because I may not have relapsed in alcohol and drugs, but I pick up idols every day. I mean, I'm always in danger of that. I'm always in danger of taking good things and making them ultimate things. And anything I make an ultimate thing other than God has me in trouble.
Was it where your heart is, also shall your treasure be found?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just wherever you put in your heart. I mean, if you put your heart into service work and being of service to others, I'll put it to you this way, I made this up. When we're in the service of our fellow beings, are we not in the service of our God? And when we're in that service and in that moment, are we not divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity? And in that service and in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator, who lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting? The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful.
Thanks.
The only sort of piggybacking I would do is, I think going through the steps is all about action. Being in recovery, being a recovered man, sometimes it's about inaction. Sometimes my action is inaction. A lot of it tends to be sort of at work, because when I call my sponsor and I'm in pain, I want something to do. Give me a list to make. Sometimes I just need to sit with the feelings. Sometimes I just need to, that great Al-Anon line, don't just do something, stand there. So what I need to do or not do is all connected to God for me. So every morning I'm on my knees saying, all I want to do is serve you. All I want to do is serve the kingdom. Just show me how to do it. That's all I want. I mean, in my life today, that's all I want is to be a servant, is to be, I'm aiming for discipleship. But because God has not seen fit to send me a syllabus or a progress report yet, I need a lot of prayer and worship because it's all guesswork. I mean, all I'm counting on is some feeling inside of me that I'm going in the right direction.
Well, it sounds like you're on the right track. It's that's why they call it a trudge. You know, it's a shoulder-to-shoulder journey, and service really is the key to this thing. Harold,
indeed.
Do you have any last words? Go ahead.
Well, I really enjoyed the program and the ideas very much, and I'm gonna listen to the archive of this program a couple of times myself. What I do, in addition to every morning and evening praying for God's will for my life, I also open the Bible and study diligently, because he's really given us a huge gift there. The fact that we have the Bible in print, we get to see how God thinks. I really treasure that. Thank you, Mike.
Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for what you said, and thank you for bringing up the Bible. It's, you know, I roll two-fisted, just like I did with alcohol, you know, two books. And you're both wonderful servants, and you do wonderful work, and I'm so blessed to have had the opportunity to do this. And anybody who's heard anything from me tonight that is of use, please understand you're not hearing me, you're hearing God. Because if it's of use, it comes from God. And I thank you so much for the opportunity. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Oh, yeah, Michael, thank you so much. I mean, you've made the website really, excuse me, you've made the website really hum, you know, with the understanding you put in there, and you've done a great work. I thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to.
God bless you.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'd like to end with that. I wrote this recently, and it's called Recovered. It's all about the upholstery. The old stuffing has been replaced with the cushion of grace and a new skin that's scotch-guarded with the humility of faith, while the utility of the strong back to service is firmly put in place. This instead of ending up on the junk heap of waste. He who limps is still walking. Ideals have lofty platitudes. Reality is few rise above, and that's why we call it a trudge. The trudge is a shoulder-to-shoulder journey with purpose of conviction. We are exclusively all-inclusive. We are less than kin and more than kind, with no judgment to be found. For love and tolerance is our code. In service to our fellow beings, we've have found to be the lightest load. And then I ended up, see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Well, thank
That's
you again,
really
Michael. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, please send me a copy of that when time allows.
Oh, I will. I will. Thank you. Thank you for the acknowledgement. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Be well.